he commits the sin with Bathsheba, commits murder, and then by age 50 is when, of course, the first child dies when he's 40, but then we see the tumultuous time beginning when he's about 50, spans that whole decade there, the pinnacle being Absalom when he makes a grab for the throne there, and of course ends up dying at the hands of Joab. So in this last decade here of David's life is when these events seem to be taking place. It's interesting in verse 3 that Joab makes a statement. He says, "While the eyes of my lord the king still see." That almost seems to be a statement that you would make to an older man, not to a younger man. You know, while you still have, you know, the ability to see these things, experience these things, that fits an older man. I also see that David is reluctant to flee 3 months before his foes. I mean, when he was a young man, that was nothing new. To flee 3 months before his foes was... But he dreads that option at this point in his life. I think it really would have been a far greater trial for him at this point in his life. I also see, too, in the nature of the sin that we're about to see in David's life, this really fits a person at the end of their life. Okay? It really fits a person at the end of their life, and we'll talk about that. And again, the point here is, one of the points anyway, is that David's response is what's key here. Is David responds very differently. Again, this is dealt with within his lifetime, which fits God disciplining his children. And his attitude is spiritual. It's humble. It's appropriate. He responds to God's discipline appropriately. Okay, any questions or thoughts before we get into our text here tonight? Okay, who would like to read for us verses 1 and 2? Yes, Dwinette. Okay, the verse begins, or the chapter begins, "Now again." What does this imply? Okay, there's been a similar instance previously. What might that be? Think about what the author's doing here. This instance we saw previously, okay, with Saul. That's another instance where God was judging the nation, and this is in a similar suit. So he is making a comparison here, and there is a major difference, and the major difference is who's dealing with it. Saul never dealt with his. David had to be the cleanup man in some regards there. In every regard, I would say. And then now we see that David is repentant for his own sin in this instance. Says, "The anger of the Lord burned against Israel." This is significant. We're gonna talk about this somewhat at length, hopefully not too long. But there are lots of players in this passage. There's lots of individuals in view. But remember this, that this all starts with God and Israel. Okay, the issue here, the root issue, is Israel. We can talk about the sin of David. We can talk about, you know, God and his role and Satan and his roles. We'll see in a moment. But this all begins with Israel. And that adds a degree of complexity here. Lots of things add some complexity here to the situation, where it's interesting to discuss theologically and how all these components interplay. But mark that this ultimately started with Israel. Now, as we look at chapter 24 here, when we look at verse 1... Who is responsible for David numbering the people? In verse 1. The Lord is? David is? the people. Yeah, we're getting into some interesting, you know, thought-provoking issues, aren't we? There's lots of players here, and we have to be careful how we put this together, and I'll show you that in a moment. But there's another player that isn't mentioned in this passage. Anybody know who it is? In the parallel passage in 1 Chronicles 21 mentions Satan. Okay, so Satan stood up against Israel and moved David to number Israel. So we have a very interesting passage. Now, I would want to point out here, it says, now again, the anger of the Lord burned against Israel, and it, that's the NASB there, it, that's really masculine. So it's he, is how that would be appropriately translated. And he incited David against them to say, go number Israel and Judah. So we really have four players in this discussion. You have Israel, you have God, you have Satan, and you have David. This isn't just a story about David. Yes, is he making a comparison with Saul? Yes, we want to draw out those points. But we get into some very intricate things here in this passage. One thing we always want to remember is what is articulated succinctly in James, and that is, let no one say when he is tempted, I am being tempted by God. Okay, so God is not the tempter. Jan and I were reading in 1 Thessalonians this morning. Satan is the tempter. Okay, he's the one who has that title. God tests people, but he does not tempt them. In this instance, who, you know, where is temptation traceable to, according to James? Satan? Where do you see Satan in there? Okay, yeah, the problem's within, okay? The problem is what temptation finds within you. So ultimately, we are the ones responsible for our own sin. You can't say, well, the devil made me do it, okay? He is the tempter, but you're responsible for your response to that temptation. Good to remember here, God never solicits anyone to do evil. He never does so in order for them to fail, okay? Now, you know, he does test people, okay, he tested Abraham and so forth. But good to remember here, God does not tempt people. He does not attempt to get them to sin. Now, at this moment, when we look back on chapter 24, verse 1, it seems that the intent is what? For David to succeed or fail?
Fail.
Yeah. Why? Exactly. He wants an occasion to judge the people. Okay. Now, why does he have to do that through David? Okay, yeah. Good question. I mean, we don't know all the answers here. We just know what God has said here, and we need to put it together in a way that, again, doesn't violate this reality, but at the same time still leaves God as God. Okay, he's not out of control here. Okay, he is in control, and as far as his using of Satan, clearly Satan was involved. Can anyone think of another instance where Satan was involved? Yeah, Job. That's one of the instances we're going to look at. Now, what's interesting about this one is Satan is the one God's the one who initiates the conversation. Okay? God's the one who initiates the conversation, but in that conversation, I mean, he's the one who brings Job up. I'm sure if Job had known that, he'd say, why'd you have to mention my name? He's the one who brings Job up, but as we go along here, this is round two, by the way. This is after he's already lost his children and his possessions, and he still has his health, though. And it says there, God is speaking to Satan. He says, and he still holds fast his integrity, although you incited me against him to ruin him without cause. Now, the way God states that, it sounds quite active, but that really wasn't how it went down. What he did was he permitted Satan to do these things. Satan speaks in terms of a hedge, you know, some protection that was going on there. And what he did was he removed that protection, okay? And then Satan was able to have his way. He wouldn't have been able to have his way without that. So here, you know, Satan had boasted, Satan had challenged and attempted to get Job to sin. In this instance, we have another one. This is in 1 Kings. This is when Jehoshaphat and Ahab are forming an alliance. Jehoshaphat, after he, you know, enters into the alliance, decides to make inquiry. He calls for a prophet. Micaiah comes, and this is after all these false prophets have already stood up. And Micaiah says, "I saw the Lord sitting on his throne and all the hosts of heaven standing by him on his right hand and on his left. The Lord said, 'Who will entice Ahab to go up and fall at Ramoth-Gilead?' And one said this while another said that. Then a spirit came forward and stood before the Lord and said, 'I will entice him.' And the Lord said to him, 'How?' And he said, 'I will go out and be a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all his prophets.' Then he said, 'You are to entice him and also prevail. Go and do so. Now, therefore, behold, the Lord has put a deceiving spirit in the mouth of all these your prophets, and the Lord has proclaimed disaster against you.'" So here, God has, again, an instance where he wants to judge Ahab. And ultimately, we're not told, we presume, because of the activity the individual be engaging in, we presume that it is a demon, not a holy angel, who is going and being this false prophet, this voice in the false prophets. But again, a very similar instance to Job, where for his purposes, you know, God employs an evil angel to accomplish his purposes. Another instance is right here. He is sovereign over all, and he works all things to the end for the good of those who love him and for his glory, his purposes. And even Satan is under his authority. And, you know, how all this works together, we don't exactly know, but this is how he functions. So as we think about this, as we think about all the players involved here, God's ultimate goal is to judge Israel. He's using Satan and David in the process, okay? He's using Satan and David in the process, ultimately under all of his sovereignty. He's permitting Satan to tempt David. He's permitting David to go his own way so that in the end he can judge Israel. All right, any questions or thoughts before we continue on in the passage? Yes.
Is this an example of disciplining the children of Israel, or more judgment?
I don't know if there's a big difference. I mean, other than the fact that, I mean, under the old covenant, God, it's not the same. I wouldn't want to call it the same as the new covenant, because the relationship is different. They're not all born again. They're not all saved. They are in covenant with him, so they have obligations regardless of they're saved or not. So, again, it's, you know, what label we give it. Just don't liken it to New Testament discipline, I guess I would say. So, yes. Yeah, I mean, you can always ask the why question, you know, why did God create? That's the big one. So why God always does it, we just kind of get to evaluate what he did do and how he did it and don't always necessarily know the why. So, yes.
Like even with Jesus, I was thinking,
Yes. I mean, he sins. And we get to see that that even in that, and as you're saying, I mean, there's a reason God judges, is because there's no excuse for sin, ultimately. He does, for the believer, provide the way of escape and so forth. As far as this instance, yeah, God does find him culpable. And there's never any excuse for sin. And there was another point that you made. But anyway, I don't know. Yeah. Sure. Thanks for your input there. Anyone else? Okay. Well, he goes on and he says, you know, his justification is that I may know the number of the people. You know, it's kind of interesting. We know that this ends up being sin. And yet, isn't it kind of interesting how, you know, when we're going down the path of sin, how we can kind of give it a face, right? You can kind of give it the surfacey justification. I just want to know the number of the people. Now, might there be a legitimate reason for numbering the people? Like what? Okay, taxes, that's legit. Rationing food, okay. Okay. Okay, been a practical reason. You know, it's interesting, when you think about this, there are different times where the people are numbered. The book of Numbers is one of those books where the people are numbered when they enter and then when they leave the wilderness. So the fact that the people are numbered isn't the issue, okay? It's rather the motive is the issue. Now, what could be a sinful motive for David numbering the people? Okay, pride. Yeah, that's the short answer right there, is pride. Some say, you know, perhaps he wasn't trusting the Lord. Not seeing that, more likely is that this is a man who he's been a warrior all of his life. I'm seeing him at the end of his life, and as a military man, you measure your greatness by what? Counting your army, okay? By counting your army, counting your military might. This is good old-fashioned pride. And interesting, we've just seen in the Psalms previously, especially the Psalm 18 that he gives in chapter 22, I believe it is, when he's speaking in that Psalm, again and again, we hear about how the Lord has done this. The Lord gave me strength to bend a bow of bronze. The Lord made me a warrior who could leap over a wall. He didn't attribute any of his military success to himself. But now, he's had a moment. It's amazing. Here he is. He's known these things in the past, but now we have about a 9-month, 10-month lapse of forgetting these things. So it's kind of interesting. And of course, whenever we sin, we pretty much do the same thing, right? We know these things, and we might have been really strong in this in the past, but strength in the past doesn't mean strength in the future. Okay, that's why we're warned, let the man who thinks he stands beware that he does not fall. Also, this is an instance of David knowing that it was the Lord in the past and knowing that it was the Lord who built Israel and made it great. And now he is actually reflecting the spirit of the nation. Remember, they've experienced a lot of success under David. Is this a reflection of their own heart of pride? Perhaps. This may be the root issue with Israel as well, is they're thinking, by my might, I did this. Any questions or thoughts before we continue on? Okay, who would like to read for us verses 3 and 4? No one. Okay, Rory. I almost called you Tony, sorry. 3 and 4. Okay. What does Joab see the motive of David as? Is there any kind of code in David, or I'm sorry, Joab's words at this point? What are the indications that pride is afoot here?
Just the whole afraid that there's about
100,000 more,
showing that there's.
Okay, maybe you have a different translation. Mine says, "May the Lord God add to the people 100 times as many as they are. May the Lord do this, David." Okay, read between the lines. There's a little too much of David in this moment right now. May the Lord do this. What on earth are you doing right now? I think he saw through David. And David was taking pride in something for which he was not responsible. The Lord had multiplied Israel. The Lord had given them victories and allowed them to flourish and for the nation to grow and multiply in a state of peace from all their enemies outside. Remember, they'd been harassed for centuries under the judges, and things hadn't improved terribly under Saul. You know, there was some victory there, but they were at constant war. Now they've experienced a long time of peace, only interrupted by internal strife. But he says, "But why does my Lord the King delight in this thing?" Joab, he gets to the why question. He's good at reading people. We've seen that before, but he knows. But he's trying to, you know, why? How does David answer that question, the why question? Okay, he doesn't really give a justification why, which really speaks to the fact that, you know, we don't hear a reiteration of, "Well, I just want to know the number." We don't get an explanation for why, at least a further explanation. You know, it's kind of interesting. When a person can't answer the why for something, then you really need to stop and ask yourself, "What am I doing?" Because what you are doing is determined by the why many times, okay? The motive is important here. The motive is the determining factor. Again, numbering the people was not an issue, but the motive is the issue. Any questions or thoughts here? Excuse me. Yeah, we read through verse 4, didn't we?
Yeah, something I thought was really interesting is that it says, "Nevertheless, the king's word against Joab and against the commanders of the army." So it seems like Joab and even the commanders were still trusting in God.
Yeah, you know, we know a lot about Joab. We've seen a lot from Joab. I would maybe put a little bit different interpretation on Joab just because of who he is, the big picture.
Right.
And yeah, I know. What I think of is who wants to go out, you're a man of war, right? You want to go spend 10 months counting people? I mean, you know, Joab is feeling a lot like a little errand boy here. This is a ridiculous, you know, endeavor. And, you know, again, is Joab suddenly growing a heart for the Lord here? Boy, he still has a death sentence on him at the end of his life. but you could see this a few different ways. The issue isn't so much Joab, but what David is trying to do here, I would concede. Any other questions or thoughts? Yes.
I think there's a lot of moving parts here.
Obviously, yes.
Yeah, obviously. But it's interesting to me, you know, how, like, bringing in James, God does not tempt people. And yet, you know, we're taught by Jesus, "Lead us not into temptation, to deliver us from evil." And I think maybe David's coming to have a, you know, he's come to where he is in life. There's some pride here. And all God has to do is just kind of pull back.
Amen. That is the sin. Yes, it is. He's got a pride issue. And he definitely had no problem pressing to count the people here. All right. Anybody else? All right. Verses 5 through 9. Who would like to read those? Yes. Okay, thank you. So that, boy, things just look a little fuzzy here. It's usually very crisp. Okay, well, the basic route that they took here, they're in Jerusalem. They cross over here. Well, that's not a certain location there as far as Jazer. But they travel up north into Gilead. Again, we're not going to get into this, but First Chronicles talks about how there were, you know, the princes of the people. So the princes of the people were probably gathering the data, and of course, Joab's overseeing the whole process. And so there's more involved than just Joab counting the people. They don't go to exactly every location, but they are going, they're making a path through the land to gather the numbers. Then you go up here into the north. They go all the way up to Sidon, down to Tyre, and then end up down here in Beersheba. So they span the entire nation, and of course, this takes 9 months and 20 days. What does the 20 days indicate? Yeah, they were counting the days, okay? I don't get the feeling that they were really enjoying this process. I don't know about you, but if you have to be 9 months, almost 10 months away from your family, do you want it to be just counting people? You could see where Joab was reluctant to enter into this role just to for the sake of foolish pride on David's part. When we look at comparison of 2 Samuel 24:9, as far as the numbers here, Israel is 800,000, Judah is 500,000. You get to 1 Chronicles 21, you see that Israel is 1.1 million and Judah is 470,000. There are many different ways that people have tried to resolve this. There's really no solid, you know, resolution to the numbers here. You know, did one number include the, the men who were seasoned veterans because it says they're, you know, valiant men, versus this included all the males, even those who had never been to battle. I mean, those kinds of things are ways that people have tried to resolve this, but there's no real way to know how those numbers ended up different. You would expect this one to actually be smaller because Levi and Benjamin's not even included. So how exactly they arrived at those two different numbers on those two different passages, we don't know. Was it, you know, a copyist error? All these things enter into the discussion. All right, any questions or thoughts there? Yes. Correct. Yeah. Yes. Not until after he gets the number. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Yes.
So he counted, he had two different counts from what I see.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, he's counting the men of war. Yeah, that's this. These are the men. Yeah, men of age who were able to fight. Well, it does say valiant warriors, valiant men. Yeah. I would say it's qualified by what's said later. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the essence of it, I think, comes out later in the final number, what the intent was. Anyone else? You can probably go back to Numbers and hear the same language as far as, you know, go count all Israel or whatever, and then it ends up being the men that are counted. So this was the standard, you know, the precedent was set back in Numbers, just as far as. Yep. And the fact that, yeah, God's judging him for it makes it pretty clear. Yeah, there's a pride issue. Anyone else? All right. Who would like to read for us verses 10 through 14? Jeremy.
And David's heart after he had numbered the people. So David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done. But now I pray, O Lord, take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have done very foolishly. Now when David arose in the morning, the word of the Lord came to the prophet Gad, David's seer, saying, go and tell David, thus says the Lord, I offer you three things. Choose one of them for yourself, that I may do it to you. So Gad came to David and told him, and he said to him, shall 7 years of famine come to you in your land? Or shall you flee 3 months before your enemies while they pursue you? Or shall there be 3 days plague in your land? Now consider and see what answer I should take back to him who said, you said 14?
14. Okay. Now, as we look at these verses, I want to talk again about this 9 months and 20 days. It's interesting, when we think about that time period, what might be another significance of 9 months and 20 days? What's usually about 9 months? Yeah, somebody had a baby. Okay, and so when we think about that, what does that sound like? Yeah, it sounds like a previous instance where David needed to repent. What's the difference about this one, though? I mean, we have basically the same amount of time elapsing, but what's different about this instance than the one with Bathsheba?
David.
Yeah, that's right. Which really speaks to what? Okay, yeah. And God, here he is, and he lets this go all the way to the point where David actually gets the number. Why? First of all, why did it take that long for David to repent or to feel guilty? Well, and he might have been real eager, but when he got the number, what happened? Yeah, it didn't give him what he thought it was going to give him. It might have briefly. And isn't sin that way? I mean, it's kind of like with Bathsheba. You see, it's like, oh, well, yeah, in the moment, this made perfect sense. And then David, here it is, it goes, he finally gets the number, and he's like, yeah, and he sat down and he ate a hearty dinner and was real full of himself for that day. And then what? Then the aftermath comes in. It's just like, this didn't really do what I thought it was going to do. It didn't really do anything for him. And then he starts to mull it over, and it's like, man, what was I really doing? What was I really thinking? Who was this really about? Am I really surprised this didn't satisfy me? See, that's the way sin is. Sin makes you think that it's going to be great, and all the buildup, all the anticipation, and then the fulfillment, and you're like, that wasn't so great. You know, that's where he's at right now, is that desire was fulfilled, and it was gravel in his mouth. Okay, excuse me. So it says, David's heart troubled him after he had numbered the people. So here he is. He is showing that he has grown. Okay, he has matured. He now, after that discipline of the Lord, here he is at the end of his life. He comes to the Lord this time. He doesn't wait for the Lord to come to him. Okay, he comes to the Lord. He's showing some maturity here. And of course, God has another growing experience for him. And that is, he offers him, you know, pick your poison. Pick your poison. And this is good. It's interesting what God is doing here. First of all, let me just point out, when it says 7 years of famine, Chronicles says 3 years. Again, we don't know why that discrepancy is between those two. It seems to fit that it would be 333. Okay, that it wouldn't be 733. So Chronicles is most likely correct. Chronicles reads 3 years, 3 months, 3 days. And that would make sense. It fits. So very likely. But again, you know, we have no way of knowing for certain. It's either 3 or 7 for sure. Those are the two options to pick from. But it says there, so David said to the Lord, I have sinned greatly in what I have done, but now, O Lord, please take away the iniquity of your servant, for I have acted very foolishly. Again, David comes to him, and it's interesting. Some of the commentators point out, and I don't know exactly what we want to make of this. Some have said, you know, for instance, when he confesses this time, he says, I have acted very foolishly. You know, is that indicating that this was a greater sin? I wonder if it's not a greater contrition. I think we're hearing a greater contrition on David's part as far as how he's describing his sin. He says, I have acted very foolishly. There is this element of, you know, with greater knowledge, the longer we go along with the Lord, the better we know. You know, we know better. Yeah, I mean, I think, yeah, he's more contrite. I think he's, you know, there's a depth here that even was, you know, coming on his own this time, describing it the way he does. You know, these are indicators of growth in this regard. All right, well, the prophet Gad, we've talked about him before. Of course, Nathan spoke to him with Bathsheba, but Gad's been with him from almost the beginning, okay? Gad goes all the way back to when he fled from Saul, and that's where this reference comes from in 1 Samuel 22. The prophet Gad, he's out in the wilderness with him, and of course, acting as his prophet, telling him where to stay, where to go. And then we also see that here he is at the end of his life, and so it would make perfect sense that he's one of his chroniclers. Along with Samuel, Nathan, and Gad, perhaps those three individuals were their chronicles that are referred to in 1 Chronicles 29:29 were the basis of 1 and 2 Samuel. Clearly, they were a help to the chronicler as he gathered his information. Could this possibly be a reference to the scroll of 1 and 2 Samuel? Maybe. But certainly, they could have been sources for both books. All right, well, he offers him three things. Pick your poison. Why would God offer David a choice? What does this accomplish? Well, he's already seen where his heart is at. He's broken. Okay.
It was the consequences would be from two of them would be involving Israel, and one of them would be involving him. Am I interpreting that incorrectly, or all three of them involved Israel entirely?
Well, judging that God was seeking occasion against Israel, probably. But as we think about this, where I'm going with this is this really sets up an opportunity, okay, for the statement, and we do see a man who has grown in his understanding of the Lord, okay? We see a man who has grown in his understanding of the Lord, because when presented with these three options, what's his reply? Yeah, it's better if you choose, Lord. It's really better. Let this be in your hands. I think this is the spirit of repentance, by the way, too, is that, Lord, this is you. And of course, what's reflected in that is, let us now fall into the hand of the Lord, for his mercies are great. He'd learned a few things about the Lord, hadn't he? He had learned that God is far more merciful than who? Yeah, than man. We like to put people's head on a pole, don't we? Yeah, we like to be severe. Now, sometimes we like to be soft. When do we like to be soft? Okay, with us or family or somebody who means something to us. You know, I mean, we're kind of the classic imbalance, right? We're soft when we should be hard. We're hard when we should be soft. That's what man is. And of course, he's thinking about this. It's like, okay, if you're going to let my enemies come after me, there's going to be no mercy. I mean, there's going to be absolutely no mercy. When man wants to be hard, he's probably going to be much harder than God ever would be. Dwight has been talking about this frequently lately. What has he been saying? Babylon. God uses Babylon. And what does he consistently do with these nations after they get done judging his people Israel? You went too far. You went too far. You went too far. So that is the way man is. Man likes to put people's heads on a pole and no mercy whatsoever. But God is merciful. And he's learned that about God. And you can see even in the whole instance with Bathsheba that the Lord was very merciful in his dealings with him. And so he knows to put this in the Lord's hands. This is indicating a very different David, I would see. A man who has walked with the Lord and he's learned the character of the Lord here. And that it's best if you go to him. And it's best if you say, Lord, you choose, not me. I'll blow it. I'm just good at blowing it. You know, you're the one that is good at fixing it. All right, any questions or thoughts? Tom. That's what I would see. Let us fall into the hands of the Lord. He doesn't really pick one. Two of those options you could make the case are really from the hand of the Lord: famine, pestilence. But even given those choices, which do you choose? You know, Lord, you choose for me. Anyone else? All right, who would want to read 15 through 17? Janet, or Jill. Sorry. I'm having trouble with people's names tonight. I don't know what it is. Okay, so the Lord sent pestilence. Given the statement that led to this, okay, this theological statement that led to this decision by the Lord, what should we conclude about this pestilence? Oh, okay, yeah, I mean, there's death, yeah, but it was also the most merciful option. Okay, the Lord, this was the Lord choosing, and the Lord was being merciful here. So this was God's decision. And it's interesting. He says, then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel who was striking down the people. important to note here. I mean, here David sees this going on, and he intervenes. He pleads on behalf of the people. His statement, nobody says here, "Behold, it is I who have sinned, and it is I who have done wrong. But these sheep, what have they done?" What does this statement reveal about David at this point? What does it reveal about his knowledge of the situation? Okay, yeah, he's taking personal responsibility. Is he ignorant of anything? Exactly. I mean, we've been alerted to that as the reader, and the inspired author has told us the mind of God in this matter, just kind of like we are with Job. Job's totally ignorant of what, you know, transpires in heaven. He's just, you know, confused about all these things. Here, David is thinking it's all him. Okay. Now, was he culpable? Was he at fault? Yeah. But the author told us from the very beginning, don't just think this is about David. So he's ignorant of this aspect. Now, that's kind of interesting to me, because as we think about this, you know, how many times we get into these situations and it's like, well, is God judging me? Is he judging other people? Is he, you know, judging the people in my life, you know, and I'm just attached to them? You know, is this spiritual warfare? Is this just Satan, or is this God? Yes, 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 yes. You know, I do think about this too, as far as whenever we get into things, you know, you don't want to be too quick to just sit here and just kind of narrowly interpret something, you know. Oh, well, this is just the devil. Well, maybe it's God dealing with somebody in your life. Maybe it's God dealing with you. Maybe it's, you know, there's all these different things, and we can see that here's David. He never gets the answer. But what is he responsible for? He's responsible for what he has done, okay? And that's ultimately all you can do, is evaluate your own heart and say, well, I don't know all the details, and I don't know all the things that are going on here. Is my heart right before the Lord? And of course, at this point, David's thinking it's all him, and it shows that he genuinely cared about the nation. He's not sitting up there going, glad it wasn't me. Of course, he's heading towards Jerusalem. He does, you know, cry out for God, and it is his plea, ultimately, that turns the situation around. And note that his words here does really, because of his ignorance. Now, remember, he's speaking out of ignorance here, and so God doesn't hold this against him. But he does question the justice of the plague. Say, God, you're wiping out the wrong people. Let this be about against me and my father's house, you know, but these sheep, what have they done? He just doesn't know what they've done, and really, ultimately, we don't know, not explicitly. You know, we can, you know, again, was his pride a reflection of the pride of Israel? Perhaps. Very likely. But he's ignorant of God's intent and just views it through the lens of his personal experience here. Now, the plague, when it stopped... Okay, when it stopped, there is a purpose fulfilled here. The purpose is tied to a specific location. It says the angel of the Lord was by the threshing floor of Arana, the Jebusite. Now, I'll just go ahead and give you a map of Jerusalem here. This is the city of David. Okay, very, very tiny, almost village-like is what we would call this today. From about here down to the interstate is how big this thing was, as far as lengthwise. Only about a third as wide. Excuse me. And right where I have that circle up here is where the angel of the Lord stopped. And as you can see, he's overlooking the entire city of David, and he's pausing there. What significance does that geographic point have? Anybody know? Yeah, that ends up becoming the Temple Mount. Okay. It becomes the place where atonement will be made. This is actually the first time, it would seem, that atonement is made here, unless, of course, you want to think in terms of, you know, was this the exact spot? I think that's what the Jews think, as far as the exact spot where Abraham offered up the ram in the place of Isaac, You know, it was on Mount Moriah, and of course, they associate it with that particular point as well. But as far as in this generation, this is the first time atonement is made there. Before that, it's what? A threshing floor. Yeah, this is where we separate the wheat from the chaff, and this Jebusite is living there. Oh, let me go ahead and point this out to you. Yeah, so we're looking, here's the city of David, and we're looking up on the hill. That is where the temple is ultimately. So here he is, his palace is right up here by the M. He's looking out, and he sees the angel of the Lord stopped up there, and he goes to meet the angel of the Lord and receives instruction as far as what to do. All right, any questions or thoughts? Yes. Yeah, and it's interesting because even when he stopped, you look at like verse 17, it says, then David spoke to the Lord when he saw the angel of the Lord striking down the people. So even at this juncture, when he intervenes, God responds. You know, there's this, while it's going on, he intervenes, and the Lord is merciful, as you're pointing out there. All right, well, let's go ahead and finish up here. We're running out of time. Verses 18 through 21, who would like to read those? Yes, Kurt. Okay. Is there anything unusual about this scene? Okay. Yeah, I don't think he's made this trip very often. I'm sure the Jebusite was like, oh, it's the king. What else? Well, yeah, he would have had to have offered through them, but he still would have been making the offering in the sense that it would have been originating from him. But I'm kind of interested in the Jebusite's response. Why are you here? I don't know. Did you see the angel of the Lord? Have you neglected to see the people dying here everywhere? It's kind of interesting how he seems oblivious. I don't know how to explain how he is oblivious, but he is, it would seem. He's not privy. He's not rattled by this whole situation that's unfolding around him. But he does tell him, in order to build an altar to the Lord, he says, that the plague may be held back from the people. So it wasn't done yet. And he saw that. He saw that there needed to be something done here. Of course, you know, the prophet's telling him this. But he had only stopped temporarily. The plea was not enough. There had to be atonement. Okay, verses 22 through 25. Who would like to read those? Yes. Okay, so Arna is a generous soul. Why does David refuse?
You can't make a sacrifice to the Lord without giving something up.
Okay. Yes. Yeah. Araunah would have been the one making the offering, not David. Okay. And so here he is. It's like, no, I'm the king here. I'm the representative of the people. You know, I'm the one who's supposed to make the offering here through the priest, as was mentioned. And it says, David built there an altar to the Lord and offered burnt offerings and peace offerings. Thus the Lord was moved by prayer for the land, and the plague was held back from Israel. What prayer is in view there? Nobody knows. David's prayer, yeah, the one that got the angel to stop, okay, is what's in view there. Now, that wasn't all, because there had to be atonement made as well, but he's emphasizing here that how this initially came to a pause and what, you know, brought about the resolution was that David cried out to the Lord. He prayed to the Lord, and he responded in mercy. A lesson for us there as well. Prayer is what made atonement possible. All right. Any questions or thoughts here? And we'll move on to prayer. Yes. Correct. Yeah. This becomes the site of the Temple Mount, of the temple. That's correct.
Not just the building, but the
yeah, I don't know. And things changed over time. I mean, in the time of Jesus, you know, the temple was much, you know, different than, you know, size-wise or whatnot. I don't know about size. But, I mean, yeah, that basic geographic area became the temple location. Yeah, well, I mean, unless you go back to Abraham. You know, if Mount Moriah corresponds to that mount, which is what the Jewish tradition holds. We don't have a scripture verse for that, but anyone else? Oh, okay. Well, here, let me grab a sheet. I forgot to grab one here.